Accession number 4757, room number 2.
Warrell Reel 2. Could you perhaps give me your opinion on the difference in performance between fighters and bombers at this time? How much of an advantage in speed and manoeuvrability did fighters have in the early 30s?
I know that there was a very strong lobby that the bomber will always get through. I think this was more on the basis that the observer corps would not see everyone coming along, and the difficulty of the fighter in finding the bomber. Having said that, in the 30s, we began to get into service the light bomber, first of all the Fairy Fox, which was with 12 Squadron, and it was known as Shiny 12, which was based on an American design, which was as fast or faster than the Fury. So there again, the bomber, that bomber, would have got through. At the same time, the Hawker Hart, which came from the same firm as the Hawker Fury, that had a comparable performance to the Fury, so there again, he would get through with equal chance. It was a 50-50. In fact, I suppose on performance, it wouldn't have been 50-50, but on where is he, it would have been better than 50-50 in favour of the bomber, because you simply could not find him. There was no radar, there was no radio, effective radio. We were beginning to get it. You used to get 5 miles if you were lucky with the radio. So it was all rather hit and miss. Very First World War.
Could you describe the other fighter pilots that you knew in Number 1 Squadron?
Yes. There were my two friends from Cranwell, Peter Drew and Jacko. Unfortunately, Jacko was killed fairly early on in my time there with a collision, air collision. And Tom Gleave, who was in the other squadron, 43, shared Tangier with us, whom I've remained friendly with ever since. We were all rather ordinary young men, I suppose, but I think that compared to our bomber counterparts, we were perhaps a little more lively. Perhaps we drank a bit more, and we certainly, I think, had a better sense of fun than some of them. But it's difficult to describe people after all this time. It's just, I think we were very ordinary young men, really. Except that we had flying as our work, which was pleasant work. Of course, there were other things to do as well. I was squadron parachute officer, and I was also the officer's mess secretary for a time. But then you had to take these duties as they came to you. I had 15 months there and was rather disappointed that I couldn't have another year. But anyway, I left in March of 33 and was posted out to Egypt to an Army Cooperation Squadron, number 208.
Before we go on to that, could you perhaps say a little more on what relations were like between junior pilots and the squadron leader and flight commanders?
Yes. The junior pilots were very much the subaltern in the army sense of the word. You were very much kept down, but not as harshly as the army, but the principle was the same. And you always called your flight lieutenant, flight commander, sir, whenever you met him. And of course, any other senior officers, there may have been more senior officers like squadron commander, but you always called your flight commander sir. And if the senior flying officer was acting as flight commander during the absence of the real flight commander, you called him sir as well. And you very much towed the line and were given all sorts of odd duties to do. And washing the aeroplane was worst, I think. You used to get this for minor discipline punishments. You have to put your overalls on and go and wash an aeroplane, which is quite a big thing to wash even in those days. But yes, the relationship was good. One thing, of course, you could do in the RAF, which you couldn't, you could have a sensible argument with your seniors. They would always allow you to state your point of view, and you could not, even if you were wrong, you could state it, and then you'd be told. I got into trouble once, I remember, because in fighting area, as it was in those days, all the junior pilots had to write an essay during their first year. And I chose fighter tactics, really sticking my neck out as a pilot officer. And having had one or two rough trips as number three, because by tradition your leader of three always broke left, and number three was on the left of the leader, you had to break even faster. And in my stupid little essay, I said that the three formation was wrong. This, of course, went all against fighting area attack manuals and all the teaching. And I expanded on it and said we should have pairs. And, of course, my essay was torn up, and I was given considerable stick for trying to teach my betters what should be done. And of course, in the event, I don't suppose I really knew what I was talking about, but I must have had some inkling that this was better than a better formation. Of course, it came in the war. Pairs and fours and sixes and eights were very manoeuvrable, whereas the three was not.
What were your relations with your ground crew like? You said that pilots were told to clean their own aircraft sometime.
Well, this was more a punishment thing. The ground crew, not bad, a little remote, yes. But you had to discuss the performance of the aeroplane with your fitter for the engine and the rigger for the airframe. And that was all you had. There were no instrument personnel, there were no radar, one or two elite wireless people who didn't know what they were doing either. But by and large, it was just your fitter and your rigger. And if you valued your performance and your skill, then you would have technical discussions with them. And of course, as a junior pilot, you had nothing to do with them on the sort of welfare barrack block business at all. That was left to the flight commander and the senior flying officer. But you had reasonable relations. They were always anxious to know if their aeroplane performed well and wanted to put it right if it didn't. I, of course, as a junior pilot, did not have my own aeroplane. I had to share one with a senior pilot who loathed me because of it. But that was the way it was going at that time, because the expansion had started. And they were beginning to get, as I mentioned earlier, at Cranwell we had larger entries than before. They were also taking in larger numbers for the direct flying training through the Short Service Commission. But they were not providing additional aeroplanes. So you were getting increased population and competition for the flying, and air hogging was looked upon as a great disfavour.
How many pilots and how many aircraft would there be on establishment in a squadron then at this time?
The fighter squadron of that time was established with 9 flying aeroplanes. And you had three flights of three. Each flight had a reserve aeroplane, and the CO's aeroplane was there as well, number 13. But you could only have flying at any one given moment under normal flying training conditions throughout the year 9. And if the CO took his out for a fly, then one of the 9 had to sit back. And nobody else ever flew it. It was his aeroplane.
And how many pilots were there?
Well, there should have been 3. But in fact, we had 6 or 7, including the flight commander, because it depended. You might have 4 or 5 or 6. That included, of course, you're probably 1 NCO pilot in each flight, and a flight commander, and 2 or 3 more, and later on, as I say, 4 or 5.
Could you perhaps compare the performance of the Siskin with the Fury, the 2 fighter aircraft you did fly?
Well, the Fury, of course, was a great improvement on the Siskin, which was had no performance at all, really. It was just a little flying machine, which was rather tricky to fly. You had to fly it all the time. It was rather like trying to fly a motor car that didn't want to fly. Whereas the Fury was a real aeroplane. It was the first of the real fast aeroplanes. I mean, you could do 120 and this sort of thing on it. You could really steam it up higher when you like to try. But of course, it was streamlined. You had your fairing and your cowling on the aeroplane, whereas the Siskin was just a stick and string with a radial stuck out in the front, which set up a lot of drag. Each of them had a fixed undercarriage, but you could really pull the Fury through all the manoeuvres very smoothly. It wanted to fly, and you felt that you were with it. But the Siskin, perhaps it was because of inexperience, I always felt that I was riding a horse which wanted to throw me. And it was the same with the Atlas. You had to fly it. You had to concentrate the whole time. Not that you didn't concentrate on the Fury, but at least you felt that it was, you know, you could look round. Whereas with the Armstrong-Whitworth products, you had to really fly it the whole way from beginning to end.
So the Fury was a more popular aircraft?
Oh, yes. It was the first of the beautiful aeroplanes. It really, really was something.
You mentioned earlier that one of your contemporaries was killed in an air collision on the squadron. Were there very many accidents in operational training?
That was the only one we had in my 15 months on one squadron at Tangmere. And that was an unfortunate one. I think it was a collision in formation flying, changing formation. The other aircraft chopped Jacko's tail off. And the one that ran into him survived by parachute. But I think that the Jacko's aeroplane went into an uncontrolled manoeuvre, which he couldn't get. Of course, with the chop, he might have been banged on the head. I don't know. But anyway, I don't think he jumped.
You mentioned that number one squadron was stationed in the same aerodrome as another fighter squadron.
Yes.
Was there any rivalry between the two squadrons?
Oh, friendly rivalry, yes. There was nothing sinister about it. It was just like the same as you might have in a school between two houses or two competitive teams. They had the Fury before we did. No, it wasn't acrimonious. Never.
Was there ever any attempt at operations including more than one squadron, large formations or combined
operations?
Not
that I saw. No, not that I saw. And even in the air exercises, the largest I ever experienced on my limited one-off was in squadron formation.
One last question about service in Britain before we go to your service overseas. Did squadron pilots ever have any contact with the RAF High Command? Were you ever conscious of the Air Ministry as more than just a remote guiding hand?
Well, the only time I ever saw Air Ministry was when I went to inquire about joining the Air Force long before, when I was still at school, and when I went to the medical exams. Otherwise, it was they way up in London And the only senior chap I ever saw was the the Air Officer Commanding Fighting Area, who was then Ginger Bowhill, who came down on the AOC's inspection once during my time. That was the only time I sort of ever saw a senior officer that I remember.
You said that you were only with Number 1 Squadron for 15 months.
Yes.
And you said that you might have had another year there.
I could have had another year or even two, but I was early on in my commission time, I was put on an overseas list. And in those days they used to run two lists, the A list, which meant that everybody on it was definitely going unless there was some good reason that he should be removed from it, and the B list, which was the reserve list, and you were moved from B to A as necessary. And I was on the B list for the trooping season of 32-33, and I was moved up onto the A list and went.
Now, your transfer from Number 1 Squadron to Number 208 Squadron involved a transfer from fighter aircraft to Army Cooperation aircraft.
That's right.
Was it usual to shift pilots around from one type to another?
Yes, it was quite usual. Your training was considered to be such that you could go from one type to another with the minimum of fuss, and only where perhaps you were going from a one engine to a multi, two or multi-engined, or vice versa, was perhaps a little attention paid. In my case, when I got to, well, I knew before I went there, but when I got to 208, I found I was back on the Atlas again, which was very infra-dig after flying that nice Fury. We were clattering around the sky, having to fly again and watch it from start to finish. But all that happened was I got a dual trip when I got there, and then sent off to do some familiarization with the area and just to wander about the sky in the vicinity of the airfield and do circuits and landings and get the feel of the Atlas again and get used to landing and taking off from desert, because we had a desert airfield at Heliopolis, which is next to Cairo in Egypt. A very rough one at that. You had to learn where the best patches were, where it was soft and where it was not. Because in those days you could whip onto your back as fast as anything in soft sand.
When you went overseas in March 33, presumably you went by troop ship?
Personally, I didn't go by troop ship. There was a big sort of expansion and movement at that particular moment going on in the army as well. And I went out in a chartered liner which went on to India. It had sort of troop ship atmosphere, but it was not in fact an actual troop ship. And we were mostly officers, a few details of airmen and soldiers. Very dull 10-day trip it was, because that's what it used to take from England to Port Said.
What were conditions like on the ship?
Very good. It was a passenger liner. And it was very pleasant. A complete holiday and first class travel at no expense to oneself.
When you got to Egypt, did you find that service life in Egypt differed to any great extent from service life in Britain?
In some ways, yes. All the basic principles remained the same. But life was a little easier, I think. In England, you tended to have a number of guest nights. You probably had a guest night once a month in which you got into your mess kit. And you probably, as we did at Tangmere, you dined in, you had to dine in four nights a week. Three nights were designated, two or three nights were designated which nights, and the other one or two you had to pick of your own. And it was only on a Sunday did you wear a lounge suit. You either wore a mess kit or a dinner jacket. When we got overseas, we found that we wore our mess kit perhaps once a month, twice a month, and otherwise we were in mufti, and not necessarily a suit. You could wear the odd coat and trousers, this was particularly so when the weather was hotter. So it was a more relaxed atmosphere, I found, in 208, and we were an army cooperation squadron. When we arrived, there were five of us. One other man, a friend of mine from Cranwell days, who'd been on the Hawker Hart in England, Parcell, and three others. And we were most unpopular when we arrived, because when you've joined an army cooperation squadron in those days, a prerequisite was that you had to do the army cooperation course at Old Sarum, which was several weeks long. Well, because of the change of policy and expansion, they decided they hadn't got time to train us, and we were to go in cold and learn on the job. Well, our squadron commander was Maurice Moore, a squadron leader, who later went down in that carrier off Norway. And he was a very grim, not unkindly, but very strict disciplinarian man. And we were lined up in front of him. And he was quite forceful as to our popularity, because not only had we not done the course, but we were extras on top of his normal establishment on the expansion. So we were not wanted, and he told us so in no uncertain terms. He fastened on me in particular, because the embarkation people had carefully lost my luggage, and I was there not in uniform, and not surprisingly he took grave exception to my manner of dress, which wasn't too bad, but he had to get rid of his temper, so he got rid of it on me particularly. Well, again, there we had three flights, A, B and C, and there we had four aeroplanes in each flight, with one in reserve plus the squadron commanders. And we were allowed to fly four in each flight. So there was a bit more flying. And we had the Atlas for, I suppose, about half my time there. I was there from March 33 until June 36. And partway along we got the modified Hawker Hart, which was called the Audex, which was much the same, had the same, and it was modified a little bit for army cooperation duties. There we had a wireless set which even worked, but mostly on Morse. The voice was better than one normally would expect, but very limited range, and we normally still relied on WT or message bags, and picking up messages with a hook slung from beneath the aircraft. Even sometimes we landed alongside the soldiers and spoke to them.
Could you describe what your training in army cooperation work entailed, and that, following on from that, what the squadron's duties in army cooperation work were?
Well, first of all, we had to learn to fly in desert and very bright conditions, as opposed to the English and green conditions and poor weather. We very rarely had bad weather there. So you had to learn the desert fly and to know which desert you could land on and which desert you shouldn't land on for survival. We had to learn to fly over desert by dead reckoning, featureless desert. We had to learn how to position ourselves to observe, preferably without being seen too much on army maneuvers and so forth, and also to learn how to instruct the gunners where their shots were falling, which was done under a code. And you had to fly a pattern for this to get yourself in the best position to see. We also did message picking up practice with the hook, message dropping. We did air to ground with our one front gun, And I think once or twice during my 3 years we even did air-to-air with dismal success. Formation flying, cross-country work, navigation with others and by yourself, visits to other countries and squadrons. We used to fly to Palestine and Transjordan and Iraq, up the desert to Matru and Saloum, not forgetting Sidi Barani, of course. And then we used to go down to the Sudan. And once a year, one of the squadrons from the Middle East Command and Palestine, Transjordan and Iraq, possibly, would do what was called the RAF annual cruise, which consisted of going down to somewhere south of Nairobi, possibly into South Africa, or across to the west coast. After you got to the Sudan, you turned right and went to the Takoradi area. These flights were much sought after to get on the one of the five aeroplanes that normally consisted of the flight, and every time these flights were supported by the bomber transport aircraft of 216 Squadron, who first of all flew the Victoria and then its successor, which was merely a re-engined version called the Valencia. These are extremely popular. 208 never got on these because the Atlas had no range at all. It was too slow, and its airborne time, 3.5 hours or thereabouts, was not enough to go from one refueling place to the next. We were due to go, and I was going with them, in 35. We were going when we, by that time, we'd had the Audax for quite a time. We were going, I think, to South Africa. And then Mussolini started his tricks in Libya and Eritrea, and the cruise was cancelled. But it would have been a wonderful trip.
Were there any particular difficulties about operating in desert conditions, about engine serviceability or anything like that?
No, not really. The engines were becoming more and more reliable. Your radial engine on the Atlas, of course, was much more reliable than your water-cooled one in the Audax. But no, they were pretty reliable. There was very, very little forced landing. Your biggest headache was to get caught in a sudden sandstorm. Three of our aircraft in A flight were so caught. And they just had to land quickly where they were and just sit it out overnight. That was in the Atlas days. And when the storm was over and they came to look at them, the lateral rocking of the aeroplane was such that the short bottom planes on each aeroplane had been curved upwards from banging on the ground. But no, there was nothing really. We always had fine weather, apart from the dust storms in Egypt. But further south, of course, you had to watch the weather.
Were there any problems about personal health in living in the tropics?
Well, some people used to suffer from the heat a bit, but provided you were sensible and took the normal precautions to acclimatise yourself, there was no problem. The biggest snag was getting malaria, and some people used to get malaria very badly. Personally, I was fortunate, so I never got it. The other one was sandfly fever, which was very debilitating. It used to take a rather long time, but once through it, it was like a virus. It was finished. But with the malaria, of course, you could go on having it intermittently for a long, long time.
Could you perhaps describe what the station at Heliopolis was like?
Well, it was originally built, I think, in the First War. 208 Squadron, the airmen had their own compound to start with, and then they were moved down into the main barracks. And the hangars were at the south end of the field where we had our aircraft, and across the other side of the field on the west side was 216 Squadron, and in that sort of perimeter were all the rest of the buildings, the stores, the engineers, the petrol, the various administrative buildings, and the sergeants, officers, and airmen's messes, and the barrack box, and a very few airmen's quarters. I think there were about six. But then very few of the non-officers, whether they were NCOs, warrant officers, could afford to be married. It was largely a bachelor existence for the men, but the pay was very poor. And of course, normally, from the officers were concerned, you were not supposed to get married before you were 30. If you wanted to get married before that, you had to get your CO's permission, and the reasons had to be extremely good, otherwise you were turned down. And you certainly didn't get any marriage allowance until you were 30 or had achieved the rank of squadron leader. And you found your own accommodation out nearby, or you left your wife in England. But conditions were much better. It was, if you can compare it now from sort of living in England and then going on, say, a holiday to a warm climate. It was that sort of feeling, because it was warm, because it was brighter, because life was good, and you could fly a lot. I did over 1,000 hours in under 3 years, which I would never have got in England. What I was getting in England was about 120 hours a year. So one got three times the flying. Of course, your distances were greater, you had to go further. And I found it all not only interesting, but amusing. I mean, it was life, you were living something, and again, you were doing what you wanted to do.